Father Fred Kammer, S.J., a Jesuit priest with expertise in Catholic social teaching, offers a keynote reflection at the Ignatian Family Teaching for Justice in 2012, which had the theme, Imagination Reform, Moving Beyond the Margins.
Good evening. I'm heartened and delighted to see all of you here, knowing that there will be a future for the work of faith justice represented by this room. Being an old guy, and I'm a little embarrassed now after the other three keynoters, I don't have a song, I don't have a coin, I don't have a PowerPoint. So you'll just have to listen to me. I'm from New Orleans, which means that I sound like I'm somewhere between New Jersey and Boston. You just have to adjust to that. New Orleans is a heavily Irish-Italian port city. We took all the ways of immigration that the East Coast did. A good cab driver in New Orleans sounds like he's from Brooklyn. Our conference theme of moving beyond the margins challenges all of us in thinking about immigration to think beyond the margins of today's debates, but to care for people who are living beyond the margins of immigration regulations all around us. Where I work at the Jesuit Social Research Institute at Loyola University New Orleans, our work focuses on three groups who are often on the margins: those who are poor, people of color, and people on the move, whom we may call migrants, immigrants, or those who are undocumented. And as I think about our work from a faith perspective, three key concepts come to life for me from the scriptures. They are the Jubilee, the Anawim, and hope. And I think looking back to our past in the scriptures can help us see beyond the margins of the present to new horizons for the future. I found over the years that the scriptures are a powerful way to break through some of the political categories in which people get stuck in thinking about issues of justice and peace. With regard to moving beyond the margins on the immigration issue, the first key concept that can inspire us all, really, to new ways of thinking is the Jubilee year, which Jesus calls in Luke's gospel the year of the Lord. Well, that was a tradition that went back to the book of Leviticus in the Old Testament. And Leviticus explains about the great Jubilee year in every 49th and 50th year, and the lesser Jubilee year in every seventh year, which professors call the sabbatical year. The sacred text explains how property in Israel was never to be lost permanently by sale or forfeiture, and was to be returned in the Jubilee year to its original owner. Intrinsic to the Jubilee tradition was that those who are indentured or enslaved, usually because of their poverty or their debt, they were to be freed in the Jubilee year and returned to their own property, to full membership in the tribe. In the seventh, or the sabbatical year, land was to be uncultivated, slaves freed, and debts relieved. The Jubilee year, or the grand sabbatical, was to be in every 49th and or 50th year. In that year, people were to be restored to their full sense of community and right order, a community of faith and fidelity, sharing the goods of the earth with God dwelling in their midst. As Blessed Pope John Paul II explained in writing in 1994, he wrote this: what was true for the sabbatical year was also true for the Jubilee year, which fell every 50 years. In the Jubilee year, however, the customs of the sabbatical year were to be broadened and celebrated with ever greater solemnity. One of the most significant consequences of the Jubilee year, he wrote, was the general emancipation of all the dwellers on the land needing to be freed. This took place by restoring all community members, no matter what their standing or their position, to a full share of the community's goods. Property was to be returned to its original owners, Slaves were to be freed and all members restored to full membership, no matter what past misfortune or failure they had committed. But beneath this custom lay a faith insight that the land and all the wealth that comes from the land was really Yahweh's. Yahweh, who had made a gift to the community for its use, in the words of the U.S. bishops, as stewards charged with working for the good of all in the name of God, the sole owner of creation. So all the community members were kin to the Lord, relatives, not to be enslaved or rejected from active participation in the Lord's family. And underlying the practice was of an equitable distribution of resources was the assumption that genuine need in the community was due to either the breakdown in the equitable distribution of community resources or the possession of a social identity, such as a widow or an orphan, over which an individual had no control. While the Jubilee tradition might be considered by many people today as idyllic or primitive, it was rooted in deeply religious concepts and presented a social ideal to the people of Israel. Well, that same sense of communality with the Lord and of the earth, of distributing resources to meet basic needs, and of resistance to exclusion from community participation, it persists today. It can be found in particular cultural or ethnic groups, but also, as a lawyer, it can be found in our Anglo-American legal institutions. For example, many Native Americans among us retain a common sense of ownership, which often runs against the dominant private property ethic of American capitalism and of much of our culture. Belief in tribal ownership and resistance to fencing the land, for example, seems close to the caution of God's words in Leviticus when God says, "The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land belongs to me, and to me you are only strangers and sojourners." And this compelling sense of the communal destination intended for the earth's goods is not just the province of ancient or primitive peoples. When I began my legal practice with the Atlanta Lulade Society as a Jesuit scholastic, I found a biblical sense of human community and the subordination of property rights to people rights built into the fabric of some contemporary laws such as well. Themes such as starting all over, and no one should be so down that they cannot get up again, or beginning again. These are shorthand, for example, strange it may sound, of our bankruptcy laws. A basic premise woven through the American tradition of bankruptcy, which goes back into the common law tradition and which is written into the United States Constitution, is that property rights ultimately are subordinate to human needs and human dignity. In bankruptcy proceedings, we say in effect to those who are insolvent, who can't pay their debts, who are so down and out that they cannot get up again, we say, "We cancel your debts. You can begin again." It's a fresh start doctrine, reminiscent of the Jubilee year. But part of our bankruptcy system involves a related concept in the common law called the homestead exemption. You may know it as something having to do with your property taxes, but its oldest meaning was that people needed to have a bare minimum of survival even against otherwise legitimate claims of creditors. And the exemption ensured that in the event of a bankruptcy, the bankrupt person or family was allowed to keep certain minimum goods to allow them to get up and get started again. But even in our modern laws, there seems to survive a kind of Jubilee in its underpinning rationale that the goods of the earth are meant for everybody and that we are one human community. If someone is brought so low that they cannot get up, the community helps them on their feet again and lets them start life all over again. As a lawyer, I also found that bankruptcy and homestead were related to another concept in the law called amnesty. It's in criminal law we think of it mostly. Amnesty is a kind of forgiveness concept, a reconciliation doctrine, recognized by most of us when a governor grants amnesty to a person confused, accused or convicted of a crime. Similarly, in 1986, in the Immigration Reform and Control Act in this country, we granted a kind of amnesty which eventually over 3 million people took advantage of in the provisions for citizenship application for undocumented persons who had been living and working in the United States for an extended period and who met certain legal requirements. The roots of this goes back to the image of a sovereign, of a king or queen who could forgive debts, who could bring peace to warring factions, who could help an entire community to have a fresh start. But they also reflect a church that believes in forgiveness and reconciliation. So when you hear people in the political debate in the next year saying we're not going to have any amnesty program, realize they're saying we're against reconciliation. We're against forgiveness. We're against giving people a chance to start again in our country. Remember that, because you will hear people say, no amnesty. Most recently, the Jubilee concept was strongly urged upon the international community for the great Jubilee that Pope John Paul II declared for the year 2000. It was called for by Pope John Paul, by other religious leaders, by social justice advocates, and even by popular rock stars like Bono. And the application of Jubilee here was to the enormous burden, not that an individual debtor carried, but the burden that poor nations carried who could not pay their debts in international economy. The enormous burden. And these countries, like the enslaved debtors of ancient Israel, were unable to pay their debts and simultaneously meet the basic needs of their people for food, for education, for social services, and for basic health care. Concepts which the scriptures had applied 2,000, 3,000 years ago to individuals were urged upon the entire community of nations. And in fact, under the impetus of the Jubilee concept, significant debt relief was granted to the poorer nations of the world by the creditor nations of the world, and is now being implemented multiple years, complex proceedings, of course. And then coming even more forward in the year 2008, at the last Jesuit General Congregation in Rome, the 200 plus Jesuits who were there wrote this about Jesus, the Jubilee aspects of Jesus. They wrote this. They said in Luke's gospel, Jesus inaugurated his public ministry in the synagogue of Nazareth, reading from the prophet Isaiah and acknowledging being anointed by the Spirit, he announced good news to the poor, the release of captives, the recovery of sight by the blind, and freedom for the oppressed. With this action, he rooted himself and his ministry in the tradition of the Jewish prophets who passionately proclaimed God's justice, the duty of the people of Israel to establish right relationships with God, with one another, especially with the least among them, and with the land. The congregation went on. In proclaiming God's message of love and compassion, Jesus crossed over physical and social religious frontiers. His message of reconciliation was preached both to the people of Israel and to those living outside its physical and spiritual frontiers, tax collectors, prostitutes, sinners, and persons of all kinds who were marginalized and excluded. His ministry of reconciliation with God and with one another knew no boundaries. He spoke to the powerful, challenging them to a change of heart. He showed special love for the sinner, the poor widow, and the lost sheep. The kingdom of God, which he constantly preached, became a vision for a world where all relationships are reconciled in God. Jesus confronted the powers that opposed this kingdom, and that opposition led him to death on the cross, a death which he freely accepted in keeping with his mission. On the cross, we see all his words and actions revealed as expressions of the final reconciliation effected by the crucified and risen Lord, through whom comes the new creation in which all relationships will be set right in Christ. To conclude this part, treatment of Jubilee, I've developed this at length because for me, immigration reform is a Jubilee concept. And we need to use this concept in reimagining our sisters and brothers from across our borders and moving them from beyond the margins into our national community. It means freeing people from the burden of being, quote, undocumented, without papers, or illegal. Just as the debtor was freed from his debts at the Jubilee, it recognizes the common humanity which we have with all immigrants, and frankly, their contribution to our economic and well-being, and the fact that they and their children, who are often U.S. citizens, contribute to our economic well-being, and their families are part of our communities and should be brought into full membership just as people were in the Jubilee years. In our fight last year against anti-immigrant bills with the Catholic Dioceses of Mississippi, one law enforcement officer put it this way. He said that with crowded jails, he said, he would prefer to lock up a drug dealer than a man who is just working to support his family. That is a Jubilee response. Now I want to focus on people who are poor as a group in the scriptures, because the poor play a critical part in the biblical view of the world and its understanding of persons and property and community and the place of the immigrant. Some years ago when I worked in Washington, I was on a panel with a Muslim and Jewish scholar to talk about how our traditions reflected on the needs of those who are poor and oppressed. I was representing, a bit of a task, all of Christianity. The Jewish scholar in his presentation began by turning to Isaiah 58, to a text that I had been using for years in talking about justice, a favorite text of mine. But he explained something I didn't know about it. This text is read in every synagogue in the world on Yom Kippur, on the Day of Atonement. And it's read after a devout Jew has been fasting for 24 hours. They come to the synagogue and they hear this phrase, this paragraph from Isaiah, which is God speaking. Now they've been fasting. Is this the manner of fasting I wish, of keeping a day of penance? That a man bow his head like a reed and lie in sackcloth and ashes, do you call this a fast, a day acceptable to the Lord? This, rather, is the fasting I wish, releasing those bound unjustly, untying the thongs of the yoke, the debtor literally wore a yoke, setting free the oppressed, breaking every yoke, sharing your bread with the hungry, sheltering the oppressed and the homeless, clothing the naked when you see them and not turning your back on your own. Then your light shall break forth like the dawn, and your wound shall quickly be healed. Your vindication shall go before you, and the glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. You shall cry for help, and the Lord will say, here I am. Isaiah was underscoring the central place of the poor in the religious experience of the people, in their understanding of creation's goodness and their responsibility as a faith community. From the time of the Deuteronomic laws, the covenant, and the earliest prophets, is special mention all through the scriptures of the poor and the special place that existed for them in the community. The Hebrew word for them was the anawim, A-N-A-W-I-M, which means a couple of meanings, the little ones, those overwhelmed by want, and those who cry out to God for help. And in the Old Testament, this group was primarily three groups, widows, orphans, and strangers. Who are those strangers? They were refugees, sojourners, migrants, immigrants. They are the poor and the powerless in most societies. Their very existence and the harsh conditions of their lives reflected Israel's violation of the social virtues rooted in their ideals, their religious ideals. Their poverty was often the result of unjust oppression. Thus they were what Pope John Paul called God's beloved poor. In this special status before Yahweh, the Anawim embodied Israel's own history of enslavement in Egypt, when only the Lord could free them. And like the Hebrews in Egypt, the poor had special protection from and special access to the Lord. And so the book of Exodus puts it this way: "You shall not molest or oppress an alien, for you were once aliens yourselves in the land of Egypt. You shall not wrong any widow or orphan. If ever you wrong them and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry." So their special status represented a combination of powerlessness and poverty and systemic exclusion from full membership in the community and the protection it afforded. So Yahweh then, God, becomes their protector. Today, many commentators on this tradition will talk about four groups: widows, orphans, strangers, and the poor. But in most societies, it is poor women and poor children and those who are, quote, not like us, who are the poor. And as the scriptures and their faith understanding developed, the care for the unwanted became the test of Israel's faithfulness. Rather than objects of pious generosity or charity, the poor were a measure of the fidelity of the people to their God. How they were treated lay at the heart of the biblical concepts of justice and righteousness. And so again, at the Jesuit General Congregation in 2008, the Jesuits gathered in Rome wrote this: "Our commitment to help establish right relationships invites us to see the world from the perspective of the poor and the marginalized, learning from them, acting with and for them. In this context, the Holy Father reminds us that the preferential option for the poor," this was quoting Pope Benedict, "is implicit in the Christological faith in a God who for us became poor to enrich us in his poverty." He also invites us, the congregation went on, with a prophetic call to renew our mission among the poor and for the poor. Now, from this tradition comes the church's current position about immigration reform. The rights of migrating peoples have been part of the tradition for a long time. Migrating people being refugees, immigrants, asylum seekers, migrant workers, and what are called internally displaced people. When Katrina hit New Orleans, people were complaining that they were being called refugees. Well, many of them were right. They were not technically refugees. You're only a refugee if you leave your country. If you're driven out of your home and you stay within your country, you're an IDP. You've been hearing that phrase, an internally displaced person within your own country. But the right to life and the right to the conditions worthy of life when threatened by poverty, injustice, religious intolerance, armed conflict, or the other reasons why people migrate gives rise in our tradition to a right to migrate. As Blessed Pope John XXIII wrote, he said, "Every human being has the right to freedom of movement and of residence within the confines of his own country. And when there are just reasons for it, the right to emigrate to other countries and take up residence there. The fact that one is a citizen of a particular state does not detract in any way from his membership in the human family as a whole, nor from his citizenship in the world community." So there is a right in our tradition to leave one's own country and to immigrate into other countries. In 2003, our bishops and the Mexican bishops wrote a document together. And they said this: there are five principles we need to think about in the debate ahead. First, that persons have a right to find opportunities in their own homeland, and that's the responsibility of their government and of richer countries to help poorer countries to make that happen. But secondly, they have a right to migrate to support themselves and their families if they can't find a livelihood in their own country, or if they're persecuted, or if they're driven from their homes. And third, that sovereign nations have a right to control their borders. We have a right to control our borders in the United States, but that is not an absolute right. Pope Pius explained further, "The sovereignty of the state cannot be exaggerated to the point that access to this land is, for inadequate or unjustified reasons, denied to the needy and decent people of the world." And then the U.S. and Mexican bishops put it this way: "In the current condition of the world, in which global poverty and persecution are rampant, the presumption is that persons must migrate in order to support and protect themselves, and that nations who are able to receive them should do so whenever possible." Fourthly, some people have a higher claim to be settled elsewhere, and those are what are called refugees and asylum seekers, people whose lives are threatened in the countries from which they leave. As the U.S. and Mexican bishops said, this requires at a minimum that migrants have a right to claim refugee status without incarceration and to have their claims fully considered by a competent authority. And lastly, the Mexican and U.S. bishops said that human dignity and human rights of undocumented migrants should be respected. They said this, regardless of their legal status, migrants, like all persons, possess inherent dignity that should be respected. End of quote. So this means this applies to punitive laws, to enforcement policies and practices, to detention conditions, to abuse and neglect, and to policies that assault the integrity of families, especially those who have minor children. But even undocumented workers, people living in the shadows in our country, so often subject to inadequate wages and demeaning working conditions and a shadow economy, they are entitled to basic human rights in terms of wages and working conditions. That a person is an immigrant worker, even one without legal documents, does not change his or her status as a human person made in God's image. So demeaning wages, inhuman working conditions, and the denial of workers' natural rights, with or without documents, are an assault on the dignity and sanctity of the human person. Lastly, my closing note, I want to talk about hope, which I have personally found extremely important in my own life and in my work for justice and in the lives of people with whom I have worked. It seems to me that we Catholics, I certainly knew a lot about faith and love growing up, and we talked and wrote a lot about them. But hope's a much unappreciated virtue, but it's critical to those like yourselves who want to work for justice and peace, who work in adverse circumstances and sometimes against what we call overwhelming odds. The best description about hope came to my attention in the mid-1990s at a prayer service with Catholic Charities workers in Santa Clara, California. It was a time when Congress was considering so-called welfare reform that Catholic Charities workers were very fearful of in terms of their impact upon poor families in the United States. And at the prayer service, the hope we got, and I got, and have kept using ever since, came from an unlikely source. It came from Eastern Europe under communism. It came from a speech given by Václav Havel, a Czech poet, who gave a speech at Liberty Hall in Philadelphia in 1986. And I'm going to close with his quote. He describes hope in words that, for me, capture the distinctiveness of this virtue, this Christian virtue, and its ability to help all of us to continue our own difficult work even in hard times. This is three short paragraphs. Here's what Havel wrote. Either we have hope within us or we don't. It's a dimension of the soul. And it's not essentially dependent on some particular observation of the world or estimate of the situation. Hope is not prognostication. It is an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. Hope in this deep and powerful sense is not the same as joy that things are going well, or willingness to invest in enterprises that are obviously headed for early success, but rather an ability to work for something because it is good, not just because it stands a chance to succeed. Hope is definitely not the same as optimism. It's not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense, regardless of how it turns out. It is this hope, above all, which gives us the strength to live and continually try new things, even in conditions that seem as hopeless as ours do here and now. I've always loved the last sentence, because when he says this in 1986, his country is living under the ominous power of communism, and it seems hopeless. And magically, which is I think what he was talking about hope, 3 years later, the wall fell, his people were free, and a few years after that, he was elected president of the Czech Republic. But he wrote the last sentence, it is this hope above all which gives us the strength to live and continually try new things, even in conditions that seem as hopeless as ours do here and now. So it's important then for us to be people of hope, to have a virtue that's important in a world of working for justice and peace. It's essential for all of us who long for a better world, a more just and peaceful world, and who will need hope to live ourselves in fidelity to being women and men for and with others. Thank you.